the first Institute of Theoretical and Computational Physics. Now, this is a more of a picture of what I just said. I am Juanin. This is my social media username. You can find me on most social media networks, including former Twitter, now X, Facebook, Instagram, not TikTok. I don't like TikTok so much, and LinkedIn, and maybe others too. Yeah, I'm also in Mastodon and Blue Sky. I was born in Spain. I studied in Cáceres, Salamanca. Then I moved for my PhD to Munich, the Max Planck of quantum optics. Group of Ignacio Cirac did my postdoc in Berlin, Free University of Berlin. I worked on quantum computing in my postdoc and PhD. And then I moved to Granada with a Marie Curie fellowship. Then I joined this Focaccia project. And now I'm a Ramón y Cajal tenure track fellow. I'm building my own group. I don't know if you know Granada. I hope you should, because it's actually a very important place. But in case you forgot about the fundamentals, it's famous because we have flamenco, and also we have the Alhambra, which is this big fortress that looks very beautiful, but it's a deadly fortress. Well, it's in Spain. It's not in a different country, in a different continent. We have shores. They are rocky. They do not have sand. Some people like that. Some people do not. We also have hiking routes in Sierra Nevada, and we also have me. This is my group. We have a novel quantum group. We joined 5 years ago. Then only Daniel Manzano, another principal investigator, was there. Now we are three, myself, Daniel, and Michalis Skotiniotis. We all work on quantum information, computation, and thermodynamics. We collaborate with a PI, Carlos Cano from computer science. And these is our a new these are our new recruits. We have now three postdocs joining: Rhea, Alexander, Julio Camilo, and we have a PhD, Álvaro Tejero. These are our students. This is our main areas of interest. We work. I mean, mostly I work on quantum computing, different areas, more on the theory side, on fundamental aspects, more related to quantum resources, contextuality in quantum computing. My PhD was more on classical simulation methods. Quantum algorithms for algebraic problems, intersections between these two fields. Did a bit of many body theory, but not enough to actually put in the slide. I just wanted to mention it, but I have some papers on that. It's not my main area, but I like tensor networks. I'm doing more machine learning now, classically and quantumly. Also, this talk was part of a project on near-term quantum devices. My slides are a bit stuck, I think. No, yeah. I have some issues with power with PDF. This is also some people from locals who work with us on quantum machine learning projects. We have some work on this area, which I'm not mentioning much today, but we are working on quantum machine learning. We have some recent paper on neural networks for detecting entangled states. On machine learning, I've been doing some data analysis on hate on social media. Some other things I'm involved in some network for quantum information with a focus on diversity and inclusion. We do conferences, although we have been inactive for many years, but I should be rebooting this eventually. And sorry for not doing these conferences for a while. The reason was mostly that I had a baby some years ago. Now, the topic of the projects I wanted to explain in more detail is a bit related to how do we prove quantum advantages in near-term quantum devices? So we all know that we can do some fascinating quantum algorithms. We have fault tolerant quantum computers. And this question of how to do a fundamental proof of a quantum advantage came up some years ago. The situation is the following. As we know, quantum computing is a field that is exciting and sometimes underwhelming. Advances in superposition, both forward and backwards. We have great, fascinating computers, and they are actually super fascinatingly cool qubit devices that can do very interesting computations. Depending on which kind of hardware you have, what type of control you have, estimates for how many qubits you have can vary from 50 to 1,000. These numbers are not equivalent. We have public and private initiatives, and as we know, it's very hard to find reliable speedups for practical applications that can also be implemented in existing devices. So we have many efforts to develop applied quantum technologies. The more technology-ready devices are atomic clocks, quantum sensors. Then people also would like to create also better communication systems, better quantum internet cryptographic systems. The universal quantum computer is this type of programmable universal device that can run any possible quantum program on it and can estimate any circuit made of local unitaries, and we don't have it yet. In between, we also have the quantum simulators, which are not fundamentally different from quantum computers, but typically this term is reserved in some communities to talk about non-programmable experiments, which you simulate a given Hamiltonian of interest, and you program just that once, but it's not a universal Turing machine. Then, now we must distinguish between analog, the quantum simulator communities, and people who do quantum algorithms for dynamical quantum simulation, like that's another thing. Now I'm talking about the first time, and it's sometimes called analog quantum simulators. They became very sophisticated some years ago. So, for instance, we have this paper that is already oldish. In 2016, there was a demonstration where people did a time evolution of a Bose-Hubbard, the Fermi-Hubbard Hamiltonian, with some tens of thousands of cold atoms in trapped in an optical lattice. They evolved this Hamiltonian in time. It could no longer be classically simulated at the time with the existing methods, meaning the classical algorithms available had time to reproduce the outcomes. Although there is some discussion on whether that's correct, but there is many arguments in favor. Now, the point is, this does not rule out that somebody can come out later and develop better algorithms that reproduce the machine. So, if you are more completely theoretic oriented, these experiments are not yet proofs of quantum advantage in the sense that we don't have a lot of evidence that they are very hard to simulate fundamentally. Now, this cat is a complexity theorist, and he's still not happy. Now, these alternative proposals appeared coming from more like the quantum computing standard community, which I presume is most of the audience here. Like called boson sampling, random quantum circuit sampling. Originally, boson sampling proposed by Scott Aronson and Akhmatov is this setting where you have linear optical circuits that are chosen at random. You have some photonic states that enter the circuit and you evolve and measure in the photonic basis with some technical details I'm going to skip over. This was one of the first proposals where such a device was proposed to demonstrate, as a proof of principle, a quantum speed up in a complexity theoretic sense, meaning if certain complexity theoretic conjectures are true, it can be shown that the circuit is hard to simulate classically in a sampling sense. We will go over the conjectures again in a few slides. So if you don't know them, I will review them later. Now, one of these first papers of this kind, boson sampling has problems to be implemented. So later, random quantum circuits appeared. So this was a proposal by Google, where you do something similar to in the previous setup, but you run random local quantum circuits on a 1D, 2D, 3D lattice in the experiment in a 2D lattice in particular. But the idea is to do randomly chosen gates in a deep circuit. There were several papers showing that, similarly to this boson sampling paper, these circuits are hard to simulate in a sampling sense. Now, for these setups, as opposed to the previous slide, what we have is more rigorous proofs. They are not really proofs, but more rigorous evidence that these devices are not classically simulable, that is for quantum simulators. So they are interesting to do a fundamental proof of quantum advantage. They are less, on the other hand, these are not so practical quantum algorithms. They don't have many applications. That if you're interested in making an interesting benchmark or a proof of speed up in a sort of Bell test sort of fashion, they are one of that's what the community picked as a nice candidate to have. If you're working on applied advantages, this is not the part of the talk yet. We have some work on applied advantages at the end. Now, the Google experiment was implemented, and there was big claims showing up all in social media and in the press that Google had achieved quantum supremacy. I hope you remember this because this was right before COVID, and then COVID arrived, and this was a bit like Star Wars. Like Star Wars, there was some like many interesting movies showing up at the time when Star Wars appeared in the cinema, and then sure, Star Wars appeared, and then I don't know, but many of them around them were forgotten. But right before COVID, there was the quantum supremacy experiment. So Google claimed that we had a quantum advantage, and then people complained in the community and with several, so pointing out several limitations. One of them being, for instance, the IBM counter argument saying the Google compare the performance of a quantum processing unit to a supercomputer, and but only comparing the usage of RAM memory and then. A resource estimate paper estimated that if you use the same computer but accessing the hard disk storage, you could simulate the same device, which is in principle correct. It was also much slower and much more inefficient, and then there was debate about it. Also, there is other limitations with these experiments are the imperfections. And this is actually a very complicated issue, but if you want to verify that they're working without fault tolerance, error correction, rigorously, then you need to verify the quantum device, and this is complicated. Because it's actually, you want to have a very device-independent proof that these devices are working. That's not quite possible yet. But you need to make assumptions on the noise or available for the device or different kinds. And then there are many trade-offs between reliability and what you can practically do in the lab. So this part, the first part of the talk is about this in part. So in these papers we had some years ago, and also we have a recent archive paper, we propose an alternative type of circuit that is another proposal for doing the same thing, quantum advantage demonstration based on sampling problem. It's based on evolving Hamiltonians, so it's more similar to a quantum simulator. These are the some of the papers that we had at the time. The result, and now I will review the what these results are about. The results were several of you have seen these first papers. We prove, as in the other papers, that if three conjectures hold, it's hard to sample from the output of a certain quantum device. The certain quantum device is different, but the conjectures are very similar. As in the random quantum circuit sampling, what is hard to simulate here is to sample from the output of the distribution of the machine with an epsilon error. So I don't, where is it? I'm not sure where I drew the error. We are trying to approximately sample the distribution, and the epsilon error that we can tolerate here, it has to be chosen a constant or inverse polynomial. For an experiment, you would like to choose it constant, so you can actually do that. But one over polynomial is also fine. You need to assume that the polynomial hierarchy does not collapse to the third level, as in both the Boson sampling paper. So that's a generalization of the P versus NP conjecture, anti-concentration of the output distributions, meaning the distributions that you get output coming out of the device are fairly flat. And what is called typically approximate average case hardness conjectures. If you look at the probabilities that come out of these circuits, the complexity of estimating a probability in average should be sharply hard with a relative error. And we have partial evidence for many of these conjectures. The polynomial hierarchy collapsed into a third level that's actually a conjecture used in computer science, which is pretty good. And the concentration, we can prove it in these settings, and at least in particular cases where we choose certain angles. And I didn't introduce the setup yet, but we need to choose certain in the protocol at the end. We do if we do a uniform theta rotation locally, then we have can prove anti-concentration, for instance. The approximate average hardness, average case hardness conjectures is the worst. It has been proven in our setup and also other setups before or at the same time as us. In the case where you don't have average case or non-approximate. So if you want to have approximate worst case hardness, that's proven. Exact average case hardness, we can prove it. And nobody can prove yet approximate average case hardness. These are different papers that prove different results. I want to move over those to an experimental demonstration paper. So the protocol that we have is begins to prepare some product state. The product state is a uniform subproduct of tensors of zeros plus ones. And then we have some relative phases. These angles are picked randomly. In the more simplest setting, we pick them to be in this set. We entangle with this entangling unitary, which has local interactions on this lattice. It's a 2D. 2D is in Hamiltonian, and this is the Hamiltonian that prepares a 2D cluster state. After that, you measure in the X space, so the qubits, you generate a distribution. That is the whole thing. It's actually pretty simple. As you can see, it's a translation invariant Hamiltonian, and this is why it relates a bit to condensed, sorry, to quantum simulators. These operations can be realized at least individually, not yet in a single experiment, in different, in cold atomic setups in quantum simulators. For instance, this Hamiltonian evolution was long realized using controlled coherent collisions. Okay, now we wanted to talk about verification, in fact. So verification is very difficult in these experiments. We're trying to run them at the regime where they're hard to simulate classically. At this regime, doing full tomography becomes exponentially very costly. And we do not have working fault-tolerant codes for this setting. There are some limitations to do what is called classically efficient verification. I mean, if you want to do some device-independent proof, collecting samples from the device and then doing some classical post-processing, maybe doing some estimate, computer science estimation, some estimator. This is not efficient. So if you don't have assumptions on the noise, you can prove that you require an exponential number of samples for that to work. Now, one of the reasons why the Google experiment worked is they actually had something like this available, but with an extra reasonable noise assumption. So if you assume that you have mostly depolarizing noise, for instance, or a noise that is mixing, you can bypass 0.2 and you have a classically efficient in the number of samples method based on taking samples from the device, doing post-processing in a machine, and running over many experimental rounds. You compute an estimator, which is the cross entropy, either what is called the linear cross entropy or the minus logarithmic cross entropy, which is an estimator. And that, if the noise assumption I mentioned is true, gives you a good estimate of the average circuit fidelity of the device. Okay, so that's what they in the Google team they did. This method is not fully efficient, okay, because you still need to do some this post-processing. And this number of samples is efficient, that's why it can be used. But the post-processing requires estimating ideal circuit probabilities with exponential precision, and that is exponentially costly. That is done in a nice supercomputer. Okay. So it's a bit tricky, but the numbers worked out, and that's how they did the experiment with these noise assumptions. Now, beyond that, we have another type of verification that we can apply to these settings. In some other papers, we were looked at what happens if you can do single qubit measurements and you more or less trust your detectors. Here, you need to assume that you know the noise levels of the detectors, which is an additional assumption again. Now, you could think this is the kind of in between what Google did and fault-tolerant quantum computing. If you want to do error correction, you need to do significantly complicated measurements. So what happens if you have reliable single qubit detection? And in this setting, something interesting happens, which is you can do other types of protocols which are efficient in the classical post-processing part. And these are similar to graph state inequalities. Like when you do graph state benchmarking for fidelity, you do something similar. Okay, so the protocol we propose initially was doing a fidelity estimation based on single qubit measurements. If you allow me to drink for a second, I need to drink some water. And sorry if I was a bit fast, but I wanted to get to here, which is the most recent paper we have. So we did some small experiments. Small for quantum advantage people, not small in reality. And we try to implement these protocols and test them. So we put this thing on the archive. It's in a collaboration between my previous group in Berlin and the group at the University of Innsbruck, Ion Trappers, led by Thomas Motz, Jens Eisert, and Dominik Heimleiter was the leading guy in this collaboration. So here we use ion traps and we implement our protocols. Now we've tested here and demonstrated a direct fidelity estimation method. So here we want to do the following. We want to verify that the device we explained is working. We can, in principle, apply different methods, including the Google methods and also the methods I mentioned that measure single qubit quantities. For an algebraic reason, the protocol that we have prepares a state that is local unitary equivalent to a graph state, a stabilizer state. For such states, you can show easily that the fidelity of the target state with respect to a noisy experimental version is an averaging of measuring all of the stabilizer group operators and on the noisy state that you have. So, okay, so actually this is an averaging, and you can understand this as measuring a stabilizer operator of the ideal state at random on the noisy state, and repeating this as computing these estimators statistically. Simply, it can be written like this: like you have average over you take a stabilizer operator of the state at random, and you compute here, you measure that, you get a plus one or a minus one. This is basically the projector for that, and you take this average. Okay, this is the method applied to a graph state, a cluster state on a 2D lattice. The operators that you will have in here are products of the standard cluster state stabilizers. Now here, tensor protocol correlators show up, which is not good, but you can actually measure those by decomposing them into the tensor product components, measuring those individually, multiplying the outcomes of the single qubit measurements in a post-processing step. And that is enough for doing verification, although it's not enough to do error correction because you are not measuring something entangled, so you destroy the entanglement present in the state. If you just want to check what the fidelity of the state is, you can use these equality and do that sort of experiment. And now what you need to go here is to have very good single qubit measurements that are where you need to assume that you know the noise here, the noise that you calibrate using some other method. You had to rely on that. If you rely on that, then the method is efficient in both of sample and computational complexity. Okay, and that's what I mentioned before. You can bound the quality also for a fixed quantum state. This method works to verify the fidelity of any experiment. Whereas if you use methods like the cross entropy benchmarking, you can get average fidelities from them, but not single instance fidelities. You can estimate fidelities with an error epsilon using 1/ε² method measurements. There was a noise in the background. Okay, that was some technical problem. Okay, let me see if I forgot something. No, I wanna continue. So the main advantage over the previous cross-entropy methods is speed. Now the disadvantage is you need single qubit measurements, and single qubit measurements in many setups, like superconducting qubits, are still slightly more noisy and slower than gates. So they're tricky to implement. Now, in these experiments, we tried to test this on ion traps. Two types of traps. Some of them were larger, some of them were smaller. In the smaller traps, we use non-adaptive MBQC techniques to try to fit larger cluster states into smaller systems, because ion traps have severe size limitations. So we also demonstrated, well, the experimentalists did this qubit recycling with ion traps. Imagine this is a 4-qubit cluster state. You would like to simulate a 6-qubit cluster state computation, as You know, in measurement-based quantum computing, you measure the qubits of a graph state, and you can do this in different ways. But one of the ways is to do it column by column. And if you do that, you can use a smaller system to simulate a larger system by not entangling, you know, like if they would have these six qubits, but you don't have six qubits, you only have four. You can first entangle this part of the cluster state, measure those guys, and throw them away. Now use them again, reset those qubits, pretend that these are now the two missing qubits that we had that we didn't have before, entangle again, consume this new part of the cluster sequentially. This is not how you do standard 2D measurement-based quantum computing, but you can do use this trick to use an ion trap with four qubits to simulate a larger MBQC using up to six qubits. This was implemented in the ion traps where they didn't have qubit recycling available. So the experimentalists actually demonstrated this. So this is also in the paper. The way they did this is to usually when you measure in ion traps the qubits, you have this typical setup that they have. They have these levels, internal levels. There is an S level here, a zero state. There is a D level here, which is used to represent one. If you want to measure that whether you are in zero or one, what you do is to do a pulse that affects all of your ions that excites this level to this other P level. At some point, this spontaneously decays here and you emit some photon, which you can record to distinguish between zero and one because this transition does not excite your state, you are in the ones level. Okay. Now, a problem here is you measure all ions typically at the same time. So what they did to measure single ions or some subset of the ions is to first do a decoupling of a subset of the ions. To do that, they use an additional transition. So they actually did a pulse from this S level to something which is the level over here, D prime. And you move some ions over there. When you measure, those ions do not get measured. So you can use this trick to measure a subset of your ions. In this diagram, so it's represented what they were doing. They were doing some gates first to do the cluster state computation, some decoupling over here, and then a measurement. Then you need to cool. And in this part, you reset the ions that you have measured to use them again. So you do some cooling process, which is the following. When you measure over here, the P, I said that you go down here. I lied to you. In fact, you do go either down here, but sometimes you go here with some probability, which is a different level. If that happens, you need to do another pulse and send this atom over here, up here again, wait until it decays and repeat the process several times, which improves the efficiency of the method. You statistically end up in zero with very high probability after some time. So that's what you do here in this resetting. And with that, you can do an arbitrary adaptive MBQC in this ion setup. Okay. Now we did some testing of the different methods. We tested the fidelity estimation method that I mentioned before. Sorry, not before the last one, which is for single experiments, requires single qubit measurements. We also tested well a method where you just sample data and then you compute the trace distance of your ideal distribution to your target distribution. This is the most inefficient method of all available, but it gives you rigorous data. You can only do this for small systems. We compare this with the cross entropy benchmarking methods proposed by Google that use cross entropies, which are, by the way, this type of estimators. And here are some plots. Here we have two types of ion trap experiments. One, the blue one, and the pink one. The pink one happens in a system which is trapped that is larger. We don't use qubit recycling. The blue one uses qubit recycling. This over here is data that you get for the trace distance. Okay, let me see. To the time. So in the pink area, we compare the pink one. Stars are the trace distance. This pink line is a fidelity. Blue and pink are different traps. Now, what we are plotting in here is the root infidelity, which is this. And it bounds the trace distance. But as you can see from also from here, from the plot itself, there is a big gap typically between the root infidelity and the trace distance, meaning when you are benchmarking the fidelity, and what you actually want is to bound the trace distance, you are committing here, you have a large gap, which makes you more inefficient. Because what we need to verify the most important advantage in the sampling problem is actually the trace distance. So you are more inefficient, but on the other hand, you are testing more. With the same method, you are actually assessing the fidelity, which gives you information about the quantum state. So it's slightly more powerful. So it's not surprising that there is a gap. The data that you see here in this axis, we have different cluster state sizes. The experiment was conducted up to size 4 by 4. So at the moment, in these traps, we can only reach 16 qubits cluster states, which is pretty small, not sufficient for the proof. And here we have the error threshold that we need for estimating, for doing the quantum advantage demonstration. We also do not hit the error threshold that we need. So there are some negative numbers in there. We cannot achieve this method yet to do a full quantum advantage demonstration with this type of verification. The good news is the method is fairly efficient, so and you can use it with relatively not that many samples. So you can translate to different architecture, and you have better numbers. You can just prepare it fairly fast and plug in the method in your architecture. Let me see if I forgot to say something. Well, the errors for the quantum area are estimated doing from with benchmarking data, and the classical errors for trace distance are estimated from directly from the statistical data gathered. Now, this is one plot. We did a few more things I will also mention. In these experiments, it's quite complicated to know how much noise you have in the backgrounds, but you can do some tricks to try to infer it. So for instance, one type of noise that you have in ion traps is the phasing noise. Typical pulses introduce random set rotations with which is the phasing. They are not uniform. They have typically some exponential envelope. If you want to get infer some effective noise value, you can introduce artificial noise in your computation and do your experiment twice, seeing gaps in the fidelity that you measure. And from there, you can assess the some value of the background noise. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to skip to the last plot and finish. And also, we compare the methods that I mentioned, the linear cross-entropy methods, the logarithmic cross-entropy methods, and direct fidelity estimation methods. And we see one thing, if the noise model that we have is close to mixing, the cross-entropy methods are pretty good. But if we have different types of noise and we're not that close to mixing noise, the cross-entropy methods can fail. They can diverge significantly from the fidelities that you have. So here we have this shadowed area. This is the fidelity estimate that you get from calibration data. And you plot what the experimental numbers for the different methods, and only the direct fidelity estimation is close to what you should be getting with the calibration data bounds. Okay, so with this, I want to tell you about approaches to verify computational advantages in quantum devices. And give me a second, I need to change my slides a bit. So we presented some different sampling protocols that for doing so, where they are based on quantum simulation, and they have some advantages for verifying using single qubit measurements. Meaning, if you have single qubit measurements available, you can do the verification faster. But the method is not available yet for demonstration. So we are going still. The technology is not fully ready. Now, the method is interesting in itself. You can use this method to verify fidelities in several setups, and you need to do experiments collecting data, and you need approximately 30K to 100K shots to do this type of verification. And the application of this at the moment, we use this to verify quantum advantage experiments, but you could also use this for, I don't know, verifying graph states. And just to mention something, we have this other work. I didn't have time to present. If you want to ask me about this, it's a different proposal for measuring something called dynamical structure factors, which are some condensed matter quantities. Using condensed matter, they are Fourier transforms of one-at-a-time correlators, which are hard to estimate in practice. And here we have some VQP harness results for estimating these quantities and some resource estimates to measure these quantities with some protocols in trapped ions and Ripper atoms. I'm skipping the protocol over here. This is a different, sorry, I have some problems with Acrobat Reader. We did some more practical working here, and we estimated that those numbers can be implemented in analog, sorry, those quantities can be measured in certain analog quantum simulators in regions that are hard to simulate in practice, not like the previous experiments, and the noise errors seem to be in range for doing the experiments, if someone is interested in looking into that. With this, I would like to thank you for your attention. And you have some minutes for questions, but not many minutes, sorry.
Thank you, Wani. So, do we have questions local here, locally, here in the audience? Anyone wants to grab this thing? Maybe online? Do we have questions online from people watching? 40 some people watching online. Anyone? People are shy, waking up. I don't know. So, I have a question, Wani. Maybe I missed it. But when you're doing your fidelity estimation, are you basically measuring the stabilizers of the state you create, or do you have to measure more options, like by randomizing the measurement, the local basis choices?
I miss you too, Ernesto. Yeah, actually, more or less, we do measure the stabilizers, except they are stabilizers in a rotated basis. We don't do it in an entangled way. But yeah, is that the answer
Okay.
of your question?
Yes, that was a question. So they are locally equivalent to graph states, but not quite. So you have to rotate the basis, right? I think.
Yeah,
Okay.
that's what I was trying to explain, but that was very fast.
Okay.
It,
Okay.
it's a comp it,
Thanks.
it's not too complicated. It's actually more complicated to do it.
Okay. Okay. Any questions from the audience here? Okay. So if not, I just wanted to remind you that we have this Slack channel. So please post follow-up questions, or ask other things after the talk if you're interested. And with that, we can thank the first speakers again and go for our first coffee break. So thanks.